Goodness me, Dr. Heather, you must be a very busy lady.
It's a busy time, Suzanne.
welcome back. It's good to have you back with us on Eye on Health.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
And what you've brought to the table to kick us off this morning is talking about fatigue, tiredness.
Yeah.
Why this topic?
Yeah, I was thinking about what to do, and I wanted to do this topic just because it's one of the symptoms that patients probably mention to me most commonly that gets sort of overlooked conventionally. You know, they get very basic blood work done. Doctor says there's nothing wrong with them. They're left to just go home and manage it on their own, as though it's just expected that we should feel tired all the time. And I just don't feel that that's acceptable.
Well, yeah, you know, I think it kind of goes in the bag of sort of the word stress, burnout, you know, in that it's become terms that are used a lot.
Right.
So maybe we're becoming a little desensitized to the idea. When somebody says they're tired, yeah, well, okay, we're all tired.
Yeah,
it's
exactly,
a given in our busy lives.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is it doesn't have to be a given.
Absolutely not. You can still keep up with the demands of your day and feel healthy, well, energized, without accepting that feeling tired and fatigued all the time is just normal.
That feeling of sort of lethargy or tiredness, I mean, I don't know if you want to differentiate between those, but it could mean all manner of things.
It could mean all kinds of things. Sometimes it's nutritional, sometimes it's lifestyle, sometimes it's hormonal, sometimes it's something as simple as dehydration. And those are really the questions that need to be sort of examined in detail when I'm doing an intake. And often there's testing that we can do. There's other blood tests that we can do to determine whether or not there is an organic cause of the fatigue that really aren't routine tests done conventionally. They can be done conventionally, but often, you know, a lot of times the testing that the doctor orders is only what the insurance company will cover, and that's not necessarily a full spectrum of markers that will show us why a person is feeling the way they're feeling.
So as a naturopathic practitioner, when somebody comes to see you and in amongst what they might be feeling or symptoms they might be showing is this fatigue or, mm-hmm. or tiredness, what do you do? What's the procedure? I mean, is it a sort of line of questioning? Because sometimes people throw these things in and there's another underlying reason for why they might be feeling what they're feeling.
Absolutely. So I do, no matter what a person comes in to ask me about, I always ask them questions about diet, lifestyle, sleep habits, exercise habits, that sort of thing. And that's really sort of the basics of good health, right? So if there is a sleep issue or a diet issue or an activity issue, that needs to be sorted out sort of as a baseline. Sometimes the fatigue is so bad that a person can't really be active or can't really sleep well. It's kind of ironic that a lot of people who are overtired actually don't sleep very well. So then if the fatigue is a barrier to exercise, for example, then we work around that until they can be active again. But the dietary components, the sleep component, and if those things are in check, then the next thing we talk about is, are there any reasons why they may have specific deficiencies? So I'll ask them about other symptoms, like about their skin, their hair, their nails, their digestion, muscle pain, muscle fatigue. What's their exercise tolerance like? We'll talk about hormonal issues. Is there a thyroid problem? Is there an adrenal problem? A lot of people have TSH, which is thyroid stimulating hormone, very commonly done test. A lot of people have TSH levels that are borderline high, suggesting slightly low thyroid function, but they're still technically within the normal range. So the doctor says your thyroid's fine, when really their symptoms and their TSH value taken into consideration together are enough for us to do work on thyroid function. So the nutritional stuff, the lifestyle stuff, hormonal issues like adrenal thyroid, I do often do basic blood work for vitamin D, for ferritin levels, for B12, and a lot of times that's not even routinely done. So it's just a matter of digging until we get to root cause.
Interesting you said that. My mother, actually, in the UK, she was feeling tired all the time, and she went through so many different tests, and we're going to get a bit concerned, a bit worried, and it turned out she was vitamin D deficient.
Yeah. I mean, I some people will roll their eyes, but I routinely take 10,000 IU a day of vitamin D, really, really high dosage, because it's such a common deficiency, because when I test mine, I'm never really over 40. I mean, technically anything over 30 is considered okay, but really ideal range for vitamin D is 50 to 80. This is like nanograms per ml. It's one of the, there's a different unit system, but that's the one I usually use. So if ideal range is over 50 and we're not, for lifestyle reasons, not getting enough sun exposure, then it's worthwhile supplementing. It's really the only way that we can get vitamin D. And the typical recommendation of like 400 to 1,000 IU a day really isn't enough.
Well, you mentioned vitamin D. We're also going to be talking about vitamin C in a little while as well. A lot of talk in the media about vitamin C, and is it really making a difference to your health if you're taking a supplement, a vitamin C supplement? So we'll explore that and your questions when it comes to vitamin supplements, but also fatigue and tiredness. What are your thoughts about that? Whether you're feeling it or whether somebody that you know well is feeling it, do you think, oh, come on, just get on with it? Or really, are you tired? Are you really tired? Or in fact, you're very concerned about this and actually believe that there is something more serious going on. People are texting in. We are talking to begin with about fatigue and tiredness and what that can mean for the individual. We're going to be looking a little bit later at more I don't want to say more serious, because actually it's all relevant to the individual when it comes to your health and well-being, but chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME, we perhaps know it as. In the UK, in the 80s, it was called the yuppie disease, ME. So we'll be taking a look at that and what that means and some interesting research that's going on in the UK. But what is they are highlighting is this condition can often be dismissed as being all in the mind, but actually chronic fatigue syndrome is real. And we'll be exploring what those symptoms are, and what's available to people to try and help with something like chronic fatigue. When it comes to tiredness, one of our listeners is texting here, Dr. Heather, saying that I sleep 5 hours a night and hour for a nap during the day. Is that enough? I always feel super tired, although I eat well and work out every day.
Yeah, good question. So 5 hours a night probably isn't enough. I think the current recommendations are about 6 to 8. Some people feel fine on less than that, and that's okay. This person's getting a total of 6, but it's broken. Some people also do okay on that, and then if that's the case, I'm not really fussed about it. But obviously there's something going on for this person despite having a healthy diet and managing their activity levels that's causing the fatigue. So I would probably start with asking questions about diet, what they're eating, the timing of their meals, and the timing of when they feel tired, and then go into some of the symptoms that go with being anemic or being vitamin D deficient or B12 deficient, and then go into potentially talking about stress levels and the impact of cortisol regulation on fatigue. And if those things are coming up as being fine, then the next step would be thyroid function, some of the sex hormones. DHEA is a hormone that's a precursor to cortisol as well as to our sex hormones. So some people that go through changes in cortisol levels actually experience that as changes in their sex hormone levels. So in women, either irregular menstrual cycles, in men, the symptoms that go with low testosterone, sort of low energy, low drive, that sort of thing. So it just means asking more questions to figure out where the sort of weakest link is. And then that's what we treat.
And for each individual, when you're looking at diet and nutrition and feeling the links or connections to fatigue, why are there connections? Why are there links?
Right. So to run our enzyme system. So every biochemical reaction in our body relies on an enzyme system to run it. And those enzymes use vitamins and nutrients and minerals that we get from food in order to operate. They can operate with suboptimal levels, but they operate in general, they operate more slowly. And that's where we start getting symptoms of fatigue. So with diet, what matters is diversity in the diet. So they can't just be, they may be eating plenty of fruit and vegetables, but if it's only 3 or 4 fruits and vegetables, then that's not really going to cut it. And we need a lot of what we need from protein in the diet and essential fats in the diet. So I want to know, are they getting enough protein? Are they being really good about consuming their healthy fats? And is the diversity of their fruit and veg there? And the other thing about fruit and veg is that the common recommendation in terms of serving size is your 5 a day, right? And 5 is really a bare minimum. When you look at actual nutrient content in food, it's more like 9 to 12 servings a day that we need. So sometimes people are being diligent about 5 a day, but they're feeling fatigued because they're only getting the bare minimum of what they actually need to run their enzyme system. So then we just talk about how to increase those foods in their diet.
I was talking to a colleague earlier and she was saying, oh, you know, I have to have my multivitamins because I know I'm not getting what I need from my diet because I'm certainly not getting my 5 a day and never mind 7 a day or 9 a day. Mm. So I take my vitamins and I really notice if I'm not taking my multivitamin. And I found that very interesting because some people, and we've talked about it before, but, you know, you read the whole sort of business side of supplements and vitamins. Sure. And, you know, does it really make a difference if you're going to be taking vitamins, supplement? And also, and that's something we're going to look at out of an article in the Guardian from the UK, the truth about superfoods. And what that's highlighting, which ties into this, is people think, oh, I maybe haven't been so good, or I'm not feeling so good, or I'm not eating as well as I should. So I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take a load of vitamins and that will make up for it. But I can still continue to maybe not live the lifestyle I should because I'm going to compensate for it by taking vitamins or reaching for so-called superfoods.
Yeah. So when I have those patients, they get a little bit of tough love from me because that's really not, you know, you may think that you're able to sort of cover your bases with a multivitamin. And, you know, in times of sort of situational change, like you're traveling and you're, you know, your diet's off because the time zones are different, sure, take a multivitamin. But your body will always absorb those nutrients better from food. A multivitamin, even a natural multivitamin, is still sort of an artificial combination of those vitamins and nutrients, not necessarily in the way we would find them in food and in the ratio we would find them in food. And that's how our body has evolved absorbing nutrients, and that's why we tend to absorb nutrients better from food. So if a person's really reliant on a multivitamin to feel well, then there's something going on with diet that needs to be fixed. If they absolutely cannot fix it, then multivitamin, sure, but they're probably not going to be feeling 100% until we get the diet more on track. Now, a multivitamin, if a person is truly deficient, let's say magnesium as an example. If a person's truly magnesium deficient and getting symptoms of a magnesium deficiency, the amount of magnesium that you'll actually find in a multivitamin is relatively low. There's so many things in a multivitamin that it's difficult to get enough to fix a true deficiency in your multi. So that person would be much better off supplementing a higher dose of magnesium on its own while we fix the diet. And what that does, when you suddenly sort of shock your bloodstream with a high dose of one nutrient, that rapidly upregulates receptor production for that nutrient, so you start absorbing it better from food. So a short-term use of a high-dose individual mineral or vitamin is a much better strategy for truly correcting a deficiency than just taking a multivitamin all the time. But at the end of the day, the diet needs to be fixed first. Then we need to look at why there's still specific deficiencies and potentially treat those with supplementation. But do you need to take a multivitamin every day? Only if your diet's garbage, and then we need to fix the diet. So I very rarely actually recommend multivitamins because if we get the dietary stuff right, then they don't need it. And if there are specific deficiencies, we correct that individually as needed.
More to come from Dr. Heather. Your questions, we're going to address those. Someone here talking about vitamin C and about fatigue and tiredness and what that can mean. Dr. Heather Ead, naturopathic physician at Intelligent Health, based on the Beach Road here in Dubai. And we are talking about fatigue, tiredness, and what that can mean and how it's impacting our health and well-being. We're also looking at vitamins as well. We're going to be looking at vitamin C, and actually an interesting message coming from one of our listeners about vitamin C. Another message here, Dr. Heather: I'm feeling severe foot burning. I'm 49 years of age. Blood pressure medications, that's what I'm taking. I walk for an hour every day. Any advice?
Yeah, so foot burning can be a sign of diabetes, or it can be a sign of vitamin B12 deficiency. So the first thing I would do is do blood work for fasting glucose and fasting insulin. Always ask for your sugar to be tested with your insulin, and also a hemoglobin A1C. And if those numbers are even borderline high, then we start working on regulating insulin production appropriately. B12, also easy to see in a blood test. And often, again, I see people who are borderline low and they've been told they're fine, but actually when we start putting them on B12, their symptoms improve. So those are the two things that I would just do some blood work with.
Lena says, I'm too fatigued to type in a question, but I'm listening.
Thanks, Lena,
for that. But, you know, possibly highlighting there, if it's a serious call out, that if you do suffer from chronic fatigue syndrome. It's a serious condition, isn't
it? Yeah, I mean, we're talking about sort of functional levels of fatigue, but chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME, as it's known in Europe, I think, very debilitating condition, different sort of root cause. Usually there's an immune insult that begins the biochemical change. And then in some people, the immune insult actually inhibits their ability to clear lactic acid from cells. So lactic acid builds up in the cell, and that triggers pain pathways. So the pain pathways. So they get the tiredness as well as pain. And that's where there's sort of overlap in diagnosis with fibromyalgia as well. But when we start working on that kind of biochemistry, then the chronic fatigue can sometimes improve. But that is a separate type of condition.
We'll talk more about that later. I want to look at the research going on in the UK when it comes to chronic fatigue. On the topic of tiredness and fatigue and diet and nutrition, just to come back on that a little bit, people will say things like, oh, I had a piece of cake in the afternoon or a biscuit, and then an hour later I felt just wiped out. Or sometimes people say that when they've eaten bread. What's going on there?
Yeah, usually that's an insulin type of response that's happening as your body breaks down the refined carbohydrates. So if you're eating something that's made with white flour or white rice or something like that, if you overshoot a little bit with insulin, sometimes the body produces or sort of squirts out more insulin than it actually needs at the time. That will make the glucose from that food very rapidly enter your cells. And that's kind of what makes people feel better when they have something sweet. They get that initial sort of energy surge, or they're craving something sweet because they want that little energy surge. But then as the glucose rapidly enters the cell and leaves the blood, eventually they get a very rapid drop in blood sugar, and that makes them feel tired, sort of brain fog, groggy kind of a thing. It's a slippery slope, because the more you do that, the more you crave that starchy carb. And then that whole sort of 3 p.m. like coffee and a biscuit kind of a thing, that's all about blood sugar regulation and the impact of blood sugar on insulin production. And if that goes on long enough, then on cortisol production, we start craving the caffeine as well. So that habit is hard to break, but breaking it is really essential for protecting insulin production long term and stabilizing your blood sugar over the course of a day.
You said at the beginning of the show, one of the reasons for bringing this topic to the table, fatigue and tiredness, is because it's probably one of the most common things that you hear from patients coming through the doors of Intelligent Health.
Yeah.
I mean, we've touched a little bit on why that might be, but why do you think so many people talk about or have symptoms of tiredness and fatigue?
You know, that's a great question. And I truly think that to a large degree, it's part of how we've been socialized, that there's this sort of private, exclusive fatigue club that you better line up to try and join, because the more tired you are, the more it means you're working hard and you're successful, you know? And I think we can talk about the reasons why that exists, but I think that's a really, really individually harmful sort of social norm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The common thing, I see a lot of women that have young children, and the common thing they hear from their doctor is, oh, you've got two children under the age of four. Of course you're tired. Welcome to the club. And it's like, what? Just having children means that you're going to be tired for the rest of your life? That's not, to me, that's crazy, you know? And yet
it doesn't have to be that
it
way.
It doesn't have to be that way at all. And yet that's the way that's the way our doctors talk to us, and that's the way we talk to each other. And we do it in sort of a harmless way, like we do it in a sort of convivial way. But ultimately, when we're talking about tiredness that's been so long standing that a person no longer even feels themselves anymore, then it's worth working on, for sure. And there's lots that we can do to restore that sort of normal biochemistry that supports cellular energy production and therefore feeling well. I mean, oftentimes when a person's been tired long enough, that also overlaps with things like anxiety and depression, because they feel like they should feel better and they don't. So then, because they're falling victim to that sort of socialized expectation that if you're complaining about being fatigued, you're just whining, you know? And that's just a completely harmful way that we talk to each other about feeling tired, you know?
Feeling tired, feeling stressed, aches and pains. Sometimes our body is telling us something.
Absolutely.
It's an indicator.
Always, yeah, always, yeah. Our body is telling us a story.
And sometimes our state, our daily state and feeling, we just get kind of used to it and don't address it. And right. as we do that, and as time goes on, we get further and further away from what it actually feels like to be normal, to be energized, to be as a human being should be.
Right, to feel well, basically yeah. to feel well. I often ask people what it would mean to them to feel well, like what specifically does that actually look like to them? And for a lot of people, that's actually a hard question to answer. We're so not used to being asked that question or even considering what that question means to us that it's hard to answer. So when someone comes into me and wants to talk about feeling tired and I ask them what it actually would feel like to them to feel well, like what that would actually look like in their life, what they would be doing differently if they felt well, that's when we really get to what it's going to take to get them feeling that way. Because then that creates specific goals that we can focus on.
Taking a look at some of the messages coming in, Dr. Heather. One here from somebody saying, my GP advised vitamin D and some vitamin tablets, but they haven't helped much. So kind of following on a little bit what you were just talking about regarding, you know, taking a multivitamin or not, and saying, could this be a neurological thing? Are there any connections to neurology on
yeah,
this?
Yeah, sure. So often we talked about B12 before. B12 deficiency and B vitamin deficiencies in general often cause neurological symptoms like numbness, tingling, that kind of thing. If the person took vitamin D and a multivitamin and didn't feel better, that just means we haven't gotten to the root cause of the fatigue. My question would be, how low was their vitamin D and how much vitamin D were they given? Were they retested after the course of vitamin D? So was it enough to correct the deficiency? And if the multivitamin didn't help, then are there other specific deficiencies that weren't corrected by the multivitamin? And then, of course, the diet, lifestyle questions. If those things are all in check, then looking into the hormonal picture a bit more.
And somebody else here is saying, I hear lots of people are taking multi B injections. Is this safe and is it helpful?
Yeah, the common one that's given by injection is B12, although more and more, and we're actually doing this at the clinic now as well, we're doing more and more intravenous nutrients. So coming in and getting 200, 300 cc's of a solution that contains vitamin C, B vitamins, magnesium, zinc, all your basic nutrients. But when they're delivered intravenously, you get a much more rapid, again, receptor production in the cell and therefore better absorption later from the food that you're eating. So for some people, that really, really helps, really shifts them quickly.
And one from our listener here saying, morning ladies, about vitamin C, my personal experience is my 5-year-old used to get sick every 10 days or so, then noticed that she hates anything to do with vitamin C, doesn't like oranges, lemons, tomatoes, etc. So I resorted to good old fashioned freshly home squeezed orange juice and a kids multi supplement, and she hasn't gotten a cold in over 4 months. I don't know which one did the trick, but it seems to have worked. Even her hay fever seems to be milder.
Yeah, so this is a great little private sort of case study where I also do a lot of sort of immune work with children. It's really common. The immune system doesn't really finish maturing until about age 8. So it's really common for kids to get sick a lot more frequently than adults. White blood cells respond. So white blood cells are the type of cell that's most responsible for fighting infection. They respond really, really well to zinc, vitamin C, and vitamin A. And orange, freshly squeezed orange juice is a great source of vitamin C. The key, we were talking about this earlier, the key in using vitamin C is just dosage. There's been some unfavorable studies around vitamin C not being effective, but the studies around high doses of vitamin C show something different. So it's just about threshold dosage for that person. And if the dosage is high enough, you'll get this great response in the white blood cells. They mobilize better and they go through what they call the oxidative burst better, which is what actually kills bacteria and viruses. So this mom noticed the change in her child. Fantastic. Vitamin C also is really good at stabilizing histamine release. So the type of immune cell that pumps out histamine, that cell membrane becomes a lot more sort of solid and tight when your vitamin C levels are really good. So she noticed the change as well with the hay fever. So I do work with vitamin C and with kids in particular because it's a really safe supplement to give.
And a sort of general rule of thumb for people for breakfast in the morning, first thing in the morning, what would you think would be a good way to kickstart your day, to energize your day, but you know, to get the right nutrients inside you? So, you know, juicing maybe, would you just juice? Would you juice and maybe have protein as well? What would do you think would be a good start?
Yeah, so first sort of rule of thumb with breakfast is try to have it within an hour of waking up. Include a protein source. So include either some eggs or some nuts and seeds or a nut butter or like a coconut milk yogurt or something like that. And include brightly colored fruit and veg. I mean, depending on personal preference, that can mean many things. Doing like a green juice or something like that, absolutely fine as long as the person isn't insulin resistant or diabetic. But combining that with a protein. So if they're doing just the green juice, then that would mean maybe putting a bit of avocado or chia seed powder in the green juice, which is mostly fat but has some good protein, combining it with a bit of a whey protein, something like that, or having their green juice with some almonds on the side or a couple of boiled eggs on the side, something like that.
Sounds good to me. Well, we'll be taking a look a little bit later on about the truth surrounding superfoods. Are they as super for us as not? You mentioned chia seeds. It's on this list from the UK's Guardian, and the idea that people are just, you know, it's a great sort of marketing tool to call it a superfood. Does it really make a difference to our health, our well-being? And when we come back, we'll be addressing this question from somebody who works shifts. Yannick, he wants to know about how to get, well, advice really on how to adjust the body when working shifts. So we'll address that and more in a few moments. Questions for Dr. Eva. One here from our listener. Does shift work? Saying I'm 4 days work. I work 4 days in the week, followed by 2 days. So 2 days shift and 2 nights. So 4 days off. So any advice on how to adjust my body?
Yeah, this is a question from Yannick. So let me just say, Yannick, that I feel for you because that's a really hard schedule to adjust to. A lot of my patients are pilots or flight crew, and they always deal with this whole body clock issue as well. And it's a really, really hard thing to overcome because a lot of our physiology really relies on seeing sort of a normal circadian rhythm. The things that are helpful is helping the brain adjust with serotonin and melatonin production. And that you can do depending, it really just depends on the exact schedule, that you can do by taking the serotonin and melatonin support at the same time each night on the days that you are off. Sometimes it makes you drowsy, so it's not a good idea to take it on the nights that you are working. And then just being really, really diligent with sleep cycle, a normal sleep cycle. Typically, people that work shifts, it also starts impacting adrenal gland function because they're having to produce cortisol at night while they're up, which normally we don't do or we do in very low amounts. So I often do a lot of adrenal work with these people as well. Usually if they're feeling fatigued, it's because of the serotonin melatonin problem or the adrenal problem. And then how we dose what the person is taking depends on what their schedule is actually like.
So for people that think, okay, listen, I'm getting 7 hours sleep, 8 hours sleep, you know, I think that I'm okay on my diet, but I do feel drained or I feel slow, I feel tired. Taking it further, what could this mean? So you talked about hormones, testing for hormones. Could it be a symptom of something else?
Yeah, so the first things to rule out are those issues, the nutritional issues, the hormonal issues, any blood sugar problem, we should try and rule that out as well. Sometimes it's just also lifestyle. They may be sleeping well, but not exercising enough or not getting good sleep quality. Then we work on sleep quality. Sometimes it's it overlaps with things, we talked about this before earlier, it overlaps with things like anxiety and depression. And those shouldn't be taboo words for us to talk about. If there is a depression problem, then we work on that as well. Sometimes it's sort of ennui, you know, you get caught up in your routine, there's not a lot of variety, and that leads to a feeling of sort of lethargy, fatigue, brain fog, that kind of a thing. There's lots out there right now, a lot of attention in the media on sort of brain training, like how to stimulate the brain, how the brain really relies on variety in our activity in order to feel stimulated, how we need to engage in activities that work both our right side and left side of the brain. So those kinds of things. I start asking questions about what they do in their spare time, that kind of a thing. And then if we make, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of making those kinds of changes.
Well, are you saying this is a good thing or a bad thing?
The brain. I think it's a great thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
More and more attention on that as part of our day-to-day wellness. But also, it's okay to feel low once in a while. I think that the other way we go sort of wrong in talking about this is the flip side. Not, you know, we talked about how a lot of the problem is we say it's okay to feel tired. Well, on the flip side, we also have this expectation that we should feel happy and up all of the time. And that is just not how human physiology or human brain chemistry works. So it is perfectly normal to go through a few days every month where you feel low, lethargic, sleepy, tired. And that's perfectly okay. You just take it easy on those days. But a lot of people feel that and they go, oh my God, this isn't normal. I shouldn't feel this way. I should feel happy and well all the time. There's something wrong with me. And if it's just an occasional sort of tiredness, ennui, fatigue, that is totally normal. That's okay.
What isn't okay and what you've just outlined there or touched on the possible, if you are with somebody or know somebody or if it's you yourself where you just want to go to bed and you just want to pull the duvet over or you just feel tired all the time. Yeah. What you're saying is it could be a symptom of depression and it's about addressing where that's coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Is it a biochemical depression? Is it sort of a lifestyle depression? Is it a situational depression? Has something changed for the person that they just need time to adjust to? Those are things we talk about as well. And again, there's a lot of taboo attached to the word depression. But I think if you really ask people, everybody at some point in their life can relate to what it feels like to feel depressed. Now, is that a clinical depression or not? That matters in terms of treatment. But a lot of times by just correcting the lifestyle issue, the biochemical sort of underlying enzyme system problems, then we shift the depression as well. I mean, there's always a time and a place for more intervention with depression. I'm not trying to say that everybody can just get over it with a diet change. That's not at all what I'm trying to say. But sometimes that does overlap with fatigue and then that needs to be addressed as well.
Okay, so when we come back, we're going to take it on a little bit further and look at chronic fatigue syndrome, ME. We'll also look at the difference or the overlap with fibromyalgia and looking at where this comes from. Many people think, okay, you want to sleep all the time, it's debilitating, you feel aches and pains, you've got chronic fatigue syndrome, but where does it come from? Why is it happening to you? And there's interesting research happening in the UK on this and also identifying some of the triggers, possibly. One person contributing to the article, they had had a viral that virus. They were ill with a virus. They had an antibiotic. And it seemed to be after that that they went into this chronic fatigue and diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. So why did that happen? And is it directly linked to that antibiotic or that virus that they suffered? Now, today we've been talking about fatigue, tiredness. It seems that so many of us feel this too regularly, in fact. So Dr. Heather's helping us with that. We've also been touching on vitamin supplements, vitamin C, vitamin D. How good are they for us, really? We're going to be taking a look in a little while about superfoods. And is this just a marketing shtick to get us to buy more certain products, you know? Or is it actually going to make a difference to how our general well-being is? But let's take a look at chronic fatigue syndrome in a bit more detail, Dr. Heather, and some of the research coming out of the UK. So looking here, a condition from the UK, in Europe, we call it ME. It can be a debilitating condition. People show all different signs of, you know, that tiredness, yes, fatigue, but also pain as well, physical pain in the limbs, those kind of symptoms, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the hallmark with ME, and this is, again, we talked about this earlier, this is where sort of chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia overlap, is this pain where you press into certain areas of the body and it actually feels tender to the person. That's not normal. And there's usually a biochemical explanation for why that's going on.
Right. And you know, it's something that is blighting people's lives, hundreds mm-hmm. of thousands of people worldwide. One of our listeners texted in to say, I'm really glad to hear you're discussing this complex and misunderstood topic. Mm-hmm. I've suffered from CFS for 3 years, nearly destroyed my life. But thankfully, I'm slowly getting better now.
Yeah, so one of the challenging things is that the conventional treatments for this for a long time have really just been targeted at sort of sleep management and pain management. But a lot of sort of pain medications have sort of lethargy and brain fog as a side effect. So a lot of people that I see with chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia are coming to see me because they can't tolerate their medicine anymore. So there has to be better management strategies than just masking the pain or helping them sleep better.
And what we're talking about here is where, you know, people are not being able to go to work, they're having to take long periods of work time off work. They seriously, like, literally can't get out of the house.
Yeah, they literally cannot physically get out of bed. Yeah, it's a different, it's a deep bone deep fatigue.
Well, researchers at the University of California, San Diego, analysed blood samples taken from 45 people with CFS and 39 healthy individuals of the same age. And this revealed a distinct set of chemical changes that were only present in the blood of those with CFS. So in many of the cases, key bodily chemicals were present in lower levels than normal. So scientists have shown people with symptoms of the condition have a specific chemical signature in their blood. They say this disproves the theory it is all in the mind.
Yeah, this is really compelling research because often people with these symptoms, we haven't had great ways to diagnose it just from blood work. There are certain patterns that do show up that we can track, but this new research is talking about a specific marker on the white blood cell that's unique to people with chronic fatigue syndrome or the propensity to develop chronic fatigue syndrome. So not only will it help with diagnosis, but it'll help with anticipating. If we know that about a person's health history, then we have our eyes open for them developing something like chronic fatigue syndrome. It's still years away from being available readily on the market, this type of testing, but it is really, really compelling research. It's exciting research.
Yeah, and again, because many people just think, well, what's wrong with you? You know,
yeah.
it's just psychological. And so this is really proving that there is something happening physically to mm-hmm. within the body. Lead researcher Robert Navu said something similar happens when this is going on, like when animals dial down their metabolism to hibernate. And I thought this rather interesting because the effects are internally on the body, what's happening as you're in this state,
right?
And this can be compared to hibernation,
right? And anybody that's felt that kind of fatigue can probably relate to that word, you know, hibernating. That's kind of what it feels like, the fatigue aspect anyway.
Chronic fatigue syndrome, the body may get stuck in this state, leading to chronic pain and disability. So writing in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, he said the blood test is more than 90% accurate in spotting people with the condition. He hopes his work will lead to new treatments as well as providing patients with a quicker route to diagnosis. Now, when we come back, I'm going to address one of the contributors to this article. It was somebody that wrote in off the back of reading the article, and they wanted to share their story. Well, you know, you've got CFS, and we will find out with Dr. Heather more about the differences or the similarities to chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia. But this person was diagnosed with fibromyalgia after months of joint pain, extreme tiredness and abdominal pain and even heart palpitations. We'll hear more about this story when we come back, but it connects to taking an antibiotic. Stay with us. Just to clarify quickly for us, again, the difference or the similarities of chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia.
Yeah, they overlap in terms of the fatigue, but fibromyalgia involves more pain. And often in fibromyalgia, there's even inflammatory pain. There'll be elevated markers of inflammation without any other explanation for why the markers are there. So the main difference is just the degree and severity of pain in people with fibromyalgia.
So this person contributing to the article out of the UK regarding chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, and the research going on. But what they're saying is that their friend was diagnosed with fibromyalgia after months of joint pain, extreme tiredness, abdominal pain, and even heart palpitations. And she began to do her own research. And after reading, realizing she'd got sick after taking an antibiotic, she was prescribed this for a bladder infection. And although the bladder infection was cured, she became very sick with pain afterwards. hours, she found that her symptoms lined up with what they call Cipro poisoning. She was able to come up with a treatment plan herself by reading more about this and to treat the pain and symptoms. She still has health issues, but she's able to work, go to college and raise her child. The treatment for fibromyalgia seemed to be just painkillers and really made her feel worse, which is kind of what you were saying. Sometimes the meds,
right,
depend, you know, can show symptoms and be hard to deal with.
Right.
She's wondering how many people could link their fibromyalgia to something similar, or even the idea of taking or over prescribing an antibiotic.
Right. It's a really interesting case because of the link with the antibiotic. I mean, we know often with chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia, there's some kind of immune insult that initiates the reaction. And that's why these conditions have also been compared to autoimmune conditions. Often there's this immune insult, either an infection or like a bacterial infection or a viral infection. And then for some reason, the degree of the immune response starts resulting in symptoms like chronic fatigue. What I would say that's very interesting about this case is that there is a theoretical link. There's still a lot of research going on in this area, but a theoretical link between exposure to antibiotics, what that can do to gut permeability, and then developing autoimmune conditions or chronic pain conditions. So this whole, we've touched on this a little bit before in other shows, but this whole link between developing abnormal permeability in the gut and how that overstimulates our immune system so that our body thinks that we're constantly fighting an infection, and therefore we become very tired, and if it goes on long enough, we start developing chronic pain. So there's some emerging research in the US happening, studying this link between fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, and what they sometimes call leaky gut syndrome, or abnormal gut permeability, and that being linked to changes in the bacterial balance in the gut that can sometimes happen for other reasons, but can happen as a result of an antibiotic as well.
Really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Something to be aware of. They go on to say that they changed their diet, took magnesium amongst other supplements. Interesting what you said. It says the antibiotic could change the what they call the mitochondria in the DNA.
Right. So this, we haven't really gone through what the sort of root causes of chronic fatigue syndrome are, but we know that there's this relationship between gut flora regulation and how the mitochondria of the cell responds. The mitochondria is the sort of main engine of the cell, the energy producing part of the cell. And there's been a lot of research into mitochondrial dysfunction and chronic fatigue syndrome. And some of the mitochondrial markers are actually measurable. There's still controversy around using those markers for diagnosis. And that's just because we haven't done enough research yet. But the preliminary research is really promising around measuring some of these mitochondrial markers, some in the blood and some in the urine, to see if there is mitochondrial dysfunction, and then treating that as a root cause of the chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia. And that is something that I commonly do with my patients. I want to know, when someone comes to me with chronic pain and chronic fatigue, I want to know about their serotonin levels. I want to know about inflammatory markers. I want to know about nutritional markers, like the basic ones, vitamin D, ferritin, that sort of thing. And I want to know about mitochondrial markers. If those things come back normal, then I look at things like gut permeability. Is there an abnormality in gut permeability that's engaging an abnormal immune response? And the last thing that I sometimes look into is methylation. This is the other thing that's been linked to chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia. Some people genetically can't engage a process called methylation. Methylation is really important for eliminating waste products. So in these people, waste products build up in the bloodstream. That starts encouraging lactic acid to build up in the cell, and they end up with this chronic fatigue and chronic pain. These sort of testing for this and this sort of treatment regimen still really hasn't been incorporated into sort of the conventional realm. It's not because it's ineffective. It's just because we haven't had consistent enough ways to measure these markers in the blood or in the urine to be able to use them systematically. But they're worth looking into when a person's been suffering for so long with a chronic condition that conventionally the only real tools are either antidepressants or painkillers.
Can you reverse it? Can you be treated and recover from chronic fatigue syndrome?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yes, you can.
Wow.
I actually get a number of referrals from a couple of rheumatologists in Dubai that send me their fibromyalgia patients because they know that the conventional tools aren't great. I mean, there's lots that it's not, you know, a conventional versus alternative medicine thing. There's lots of ways that conventional medicine is hugely, hugely helpful. But there's a few ways where our tools are relatively limited. And when we start looking at some of the functional methods of testing, looking a bit deeper in what we can measure, then we get somewhere with treatment.
Our listeners text in to say that you know, they're saying it's nice to hear it, that you're talking about depression, because I'm undergoing very severe depression. I have been for the last 2 to 3 years now. I can't talk to anyone. I'm tired of telling my husband, but he's so busy. I have all the symptoms you've been talking about when it comes to fatigue, but also depression. But I'm on my feet all day. I work in construction and I have bad pain at times as well. What can we do?
Yeah, great description of what it's like to feel this way on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, really, I sort of say this to my patients sometimes. People like this need an intervention. They need someone to actually intervene and say, okay, here's aspects of your life that we can work on right now. Here's aspects of your life that we can work on in 3 to 4 months' time. Here's aspects that we can work on, give us another 6 months. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So at a very basic level, just looking at what her day-to-day routine is like in terms of stress levels, in terms of lifestyle management, eating habits, sleep habits, etc., and where can we start doing work in those areas. When there's a real clinical depression, they need to talk to someone. They need to talk to a professional about it. So I often very commonly refer out for that sort of thing as well. Again, that's something that we don't do enough of. You know, we take our car in for maintenance, but we don't take our own brains and souls in for maintenance, right? So if she needs someone to just talk to about how she's feeling, then we get her to that person. And those two things work really well together, having someone that can help you with the basic sort of day-to-day health-related questions, and someone who can do, from a professional perspective, who can do some of the talk therapy as well.
What I'm loving to hear from you, Dr. Heather, is that you're, you know, working across different health and well-being facilities to get the right treatment to the individual is so important, to be collaborative.
Absolutely.
As practitioners rather than just working in isolation. What this person's done today for everybody else is highlight, I think, a very common scenario where people can't get off the treadmill, literally get off the light treadmill life. You're working, you're both busy, your husband, your wife, but I'm just soldiering on, feeling the way I'm feeling.
Absolutely.
And, you know, as human beings, what that can do to the body and your health in the long term, if you don't address these issues, can be quite serious.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And in a lot of cases, it doesn't take a lot to start feeling better. We just need to be able to figure that out in a targeted way, right? I mean, we all know about eating well and drinking enough water and exercising, blah, blah, blah. Those things are important. But sometimes it's just unlocking one tiny door of something that maybe the person had never thought of was off, and then they start feeling better and the rest of those things start falling into place. You know what I mean? Just starting sort of with something simple. The other thing that I would like to say about this comment, and I'm not sure if this is what's going on for this person, but a lot of times we rely on our spouse to be our counselor and therapist and doctor, etc., and that more often than not doesn't work. So she's mentioning that she's trying to talk to her husband about it and he's too busy. That's okay. If he's too busy, he doesn't need to be the therapist or the doctor. We can get her to someone else who can fulfill that duty and that role.
People are asking how to connect with you, Dr. Heather. So as always, we've posted up details on our blog post today. It's on our social media as well at DubaiEye1038.com. And basically Intelligent Health, the clinic there on the Beach Road. You're in Sunset Mall.
Yes, in Sunset Mall on Beach Road.
Yes, with a lovely view of the beach.
A lovely, beautiful view.
What a fantastic location. What a nice place to work in.
It is beautiful.
Yeah. We've been talking about fatigue. We've been talking about vitamins, vitamin C, all manner of things today. But Dr. Heather helps people oh, as I said, she's a naturopath. But conditions like, you know, allergies, even if you're having issues with fertility, hormone imbalance, digestive issues, weight management. But the messages today, let's look at some of the messages come in. One here from Sabrina saying, my husband has hives. He's had hives for months now. He gets hives from seafood, red meat, nuts, certain fruits, and has been relying on antihistamines. Is this a case of toxic liver?
Yeah, good question. I don't really like the term toxic liver because the liver's job is to remove toxins from the blood. So your liver can't itself become toxic. The liver, it can become overwhelmed in terms of its function, but the liver itself doesn't become toxic. The question is about his hives and why he's developing hives all of a sudden. Developing hives all of a sudden is different than having an allergy your whole life and having had, you know, hives your whole life when you eat seafood or whatever. So something is going on with this person's histamine production that he's suddenly been stimulated to produce more histamine than normal. Some of the reasons for that are that histamine is metabolized in the liver. So if the liver is busy with something else, metabolizing something else, then that can lead histamine to build up in the bloodstream and you become more sensitive to low-grade allergens. It can also actually be a gut permeability problem. I see this really commonly where the person has been through something that has affected gut permeability, either multiple courses of antibiotics or food poisoning or some other infection, and then suddenly they start developing allergies that they've never had, because once that gut lining has been breached, the immune cells in the bloodstream start coming into contact with things that they normally wouldn't come into contact with, and that can stimulate an immune response that's new, and therefore development of new types of allergies. So the typical treatment approach that I would use with this person is to look at what the allergies actually are so that we can give them a break from those things in the short term. Look at gut permeability. It's something we can test for. And if it is abnormal, then we focus on restoring normal gut permeability, and that usually allows the histamine to come back down on its own. In terms of stabilizing histamine production, high doses of vitamin C are helpful, and by high dose, I mean over 4,000 or 5,000 milligrams a day. There's a bioflavonoid called quercetin that's really helpful. Zinc is really helpful, so I'll often start supplementing with those things as well. If the gut permeability is normal and there's no history of injury to gut lining, then it may be a question of liver function. And that just means what else is going on in his life that his liver might be sort of overworked and underpaid. But that's a lot different than having abnormal liver enzymes. So a lot of people can have waste products building up in the bloodstream and it's still not actually damaging the liver. It's just that the liver isn't functioning optimally. And that won't show on a normal blood test for liver function.
She's also asking about her daughter. My 14-year-old daughter has had sweaty hands and feet for a couple of years and has once had severe foot pain where her feet felt very, very cold. She's also very emotional and feels anxiety often in certain situations.
Yeah, so that can be many, many different. I mean, I would need more information to really suggest what's going on. But the sudden sort of sweatiness in the hands and feet is often a bit of a hormonal change. And obviously, 14 years old, there's a lot of that going on. I would probably want to know what her thyroid function is like and basic sort of what her hemoglobin ferritin levels are like. Because if you're anemic, that causes circulatory changes that can result in things like suddenly cold extremities. So those are the two main areas that I would work up immediately. If there's joint pain, like pain in the feet, then vitamin D, often in teenagers, they're growing really, really quickly. So a low-grade vitamin D or mineral deficiency will suddenly start causing symptoms. So that's where I would start with the daughter.
Christopher's asking if you can help at all as a naturopath with his child who has autism or symptoms to do with autism.
Yeah.
Can diet help?
Yeah, great question. So I do work with a lot of autism spectrum kids. And again, when you look at the research around does diet help, does diet not help, there's a lot of controversy around whether or not those things are effective. The controversy is because we still don't really know what causes autism. So that hasn't allowed us to really standardize a treatment protocol. I do see that a lot of autistic kids respond well to diet change. Certainly not all of them. I'd say of the kids that I see, about 70% of them respond. So, you know, when I talk to parents with autistic kids, that kind of percentage to me makes it worth at least trying. It's not a dangerous type of treatment to start changing someone's diet. And if they're going to respond, fantastic. If they're not going to respond, then at least we tried, right? But again, the controversy around whether or not diet is effective, there's some research that shows it is. There's some research that shows it is not. And that's just because we still don't know what we do know. It's not that we don't know what the root cause of autism is. It's that there's so many different potential root causes of autism. And treating it, you know, for any condition, treatment being reliable really depends on us knowing a root cause. So when the diet changes work, it's fantastic. When they don't work, then at least we've tried. But yeah, I do see a lot of autistic kids.
And here, my husband suffers from osteoarthritis. He has a lot of pain in his hands, one finger totally useless. The pain is spreading to his wrists now. Is there anything you can do to help?
Yes. So again, with osteoarthritis, we look at nutritional status, mineral status, vitamin D status. We look at what the inflammatory markers are doing, what CRP and ESR are like. And then there's great treatments for lowering CRP and ESR, diet-related treatments, as well as high-dose omega-3s. So in the omega-3, anyone with an inflammatory type of condition needs a high dose of EPA. So the person needs to look at the amount of EPA in their supplement and get at least 1,800, 2,000 milligrams of EPA a
day. What is EPA?
EPA is eicosapentaenoic acid. It's part of the omega-3 family of fatty acids. And the EPA is specifically anti-inflammatory. But you need the right dosage. So one fish oil supplement may work, the other one may not. If you're not sure which one to buy, just look at the amount of EPA and get that at least 1,800 milligrams of EPA, not of total oil, of EPA.
Just coming back on the vitamin C dosage, you were saying earlier that higher dosage is good.
Yep.
What's recommended?
So the RDA for vitamin C is, I think it's about 1,000 milligrams a day or something like that, which is what we need for our basic nutritional requirements. But to do something like accelerate white blood cell mobilization to the site of an infection, we need what they call an orthomolecular dose, which is essentially a high, very high dose. A lot of people get loose bowel movements with vitamin C, so it can be hard to get a high dose. But I usually try to start people around 4,000 to 5,000 milligrams a day, and then we work up to bowel tolerance. Vitamin C is metabolized in the kidneys, so if the person has normal kidney function, they're not going to overdose on vitamin C. Even if you do take vitamin C, even if you do take too much vitamin C, the most common sort of overdose symptom is just loose stool. So it's not dangerous to take high amounts. But again, we work to bowel tolerance. Usually 4,000 to 5,000 milligrams a day is enough to see the impact on the immune system. I don't take it routinely myself because my immune system is fairly well, but a lot of people that have been through the frustration of getting sick again and again and again do really well on high doses of vitamin C.
Now, the truth about superfoods, according to the UK's Guardian newspaper, how hipster is seaweed? Are avocados actually a disaster, really, for the environment? Do goji berries really mean that we're going to live forever? We'll come back and get Dr. Heather's thoughts about superfoods. It says here, the top line, few lies can be told in one word, but superfood manages it. Ooh, stay with us. Kale, avocados, chia seeds.
Yum.
And goji berries. They're all supposed to be good for us. They are under that umbrella that is the word superfood. They're superfoods. But according to this article written by Leo Benedictus in the Guardian's UK newspaper, just as of yesterday, so hot off the press, well, that word could be a lie. They're not superfoods. It's not really a superfood. What does it mean to you, Dr. Heather?
Yeah, this is actually one of my little personal pet peeves. I mean, they're food. It's food. I don't think that there's necessarily any such thing as a superfood. We know that some of the components that make goji berries really great for us are also there in regular berries and blueberries and blackberries and that sort of thing. So there's no need to go and exploit a whole crop of an endangered plant just for the sake of getting a few goji berries into your oatmeal in the morning. So, I mean, there's an environmental impact with labeling something a superfood. We saw that with quinoa, that quinoa crops got hugely exploited, and now there's economical exploitation in areas that grow quinoa traditionally. So that's why I don't like, from a political perspective, that's why I don't like that word. From a, you know, sort of nutrition perspective, I don't like that word because it implies that we can get away with months of a crappy diet just by throwing in a couple of goji berries into our breakfast, or just by, you know, making a kale smoothie every day, which isn't true. So if our diet is relatively healthy consistently, there's no particular benefit to including these quote unquote superfoods into our diet. I mean, things like avocado is considered a superfood because of the beneficial fats that are in the avocado. And avocado is a great source of beneficial fats, but there's beneficial fats in other foods as well, nuts and seeds, wild fish, etc. So if we're including a diversity of those foods in our diet, we don't need to go out and spend the money on superfoods and participate in some of the exploitation that has happened as a result.
Yeah, and that kind of, you know, it's business, it's marketing, it's the same, we've talked about this many times on the show, on the food show as well on a Thursday, is that labeling something as healthy
right.
comes with a premium, possibly a price sometimes,
right.
but also then as consumers, we separate, oh, that's healthy, that's not healthy.
Right. And
it's all food.
That's right, it's all food, and there's the healthy isn't a black and white term. Healthy is a relative term. So, you know, you're not going to undo 20 years of smoking cigarettes with avocados. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, you need to quit smoking in order to improve your health, right? So I resist sort of classifying things that way. People ask me questions like that all the time. Is food A or food B healthy for me? And it's like, well, health is relative. So let's look at what else is going on in your day-to-day life that would allow us to decide whether it's relevant to include more of that food or less of that food.
It is difficult, though, you know, especially with social media. I'm falling foul to this. I get the headline, the feed coming in on social media,
sure.
and you see it, whether it's, you know, drink more pomegranate juice and
right.
you think, okay, well, I can do that. It's easy. I'll just have more pomegranate juice every day.
Right.
Why not?
Yeah.
And so it's not necessarily saying they're not good for you, but it's not always about this means you won't get cancer.
Exactly.
You know, where we get it's very powerful.
Oh, the whole issue of false claims in the health and nutrition industry is a big issue. That's a huge issue. And I get frustrated by it just like everybody else does. I get really... it chaps me when I see false claims being made really, really liberally. And, you know, I work in sort of the health and wellness industry, so it's rampant in my industry, right? And then I feel like I have to be sort of a spokesperson for what's real and rational and science-based and what's just hype and marketing. There's still so little regulation in the field of nutrition and supplements and that sort of thing when it comes to false claims that it's really easy for people to fall prey. And especially when they're coming at it from a vulnerable perspective, they're feeling unwell, they're feeling sick, maybe they're dealing with a really scary diagnosis. They want to believe that high doses of vitamin C or goji berries are going to cure their cancer. And in truth, it's going to take a lot more than that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Not to say they're not good for you.
Not to say they're not good for you.
Oh, well, what's the point? It's about getting that varied, good range of fresh, good, as good as you can food into your diet every
right.
single day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Hydration, water, exercise, just get the balance. Let's address this message coming in. It's a really important one. This person's saying that they tripped and broke their leg with a double spiral fracture back in May.
Ouch.
Yeah, really ouch. Now, any food, super or other, is what our listener's saying. What would help repair something like this, a fracture like this?
Right.
But also, they had half their thyroid removed due to a tumour in March and gallbladder removed 18 years ago. Feeling okay, but would a visit to a naturopath help? They have four-year-old twins. So there's a lot going
okay,
on there.
Okay, so basically just right off the bat, like gold medal for managing a double spiral fracture and running after four-year-old twins. In terms of repair with the fracture, definitely a good mineralizing supplement. So a mineralizing supplement has things like vitamin K in it. It has silica in it, has boron in it, vanadium in it. There's a couple of good ones on the market in Dubai. by. Sometimes I get people to order stuff online that's not available here. But basically, a supplement that is really focused on building bone. So that's a lot more than just vitamin D and calcium. So that's where I would start. And then making sure that she's got a good sort of a physiotherapy regimen lined up after she's, when it's time, after the initial fracture. I mean, it's been since May, so she probably already started her physio. The thyroid issue, your thyroid can function fairly normally if it's just been a partial removal. So we just need to know where she is now. And again, with the gallbladder issue, that may or may not be affecting her right now. You can adjust digestively without a gallbladder. So it, you know, first priority would just be on good recovery from the fracture. And second priority would just be on her all over well-being. How is she feeling on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Susan's asking, is it a good idea to take a daily probiotic indefinitely?
Yeah, I don't necessarily think that any supplements are needed indefinitely. Of the supplement categories, a probiotic, taking a probiotic for sort of a 3-month phase a couple of times a year is a really good idea, because most of us are faced with sort of daily issues that can impact on gut flora. Even stress impacts on gut flora. So in that respect, taking a regular course of a probiotic, I think, is a good idea, but not necessarily indefinitely, like doing a 3-month course, then a 3-month break, then another 3-month course. But that's always sort of symptom dependent and also lifestyle dependent. You know, if at any point this person goes through a course of antibiotics for whatever reason, then always follow it with a course of probiotics.
Somebody here, they've got pigmentation to the face. I don't know if this is really a question for you, but it is, they're saying, you know, is there a cure and is it down to poor liver? We hear the term liver spots, don't we? It's really bothering them. In fact, they feel really depressed about it.
Yeah, so the term liver spot has nothing to do with liver function. It was just originally called that because of the color and the shape of the spots. It just looked like a liver. So there's no reason to suspect that a pigmentation change is necessarily related to liver. But in women, it's commonly related to a hormonal change. So when we treat the hormonal issue, then the pigmentation improves. The other thing that can commonly cause pigmentation is just low-grade eczema, and often it doesn't get diagnosed as eczema because it's not obviously weepy, open, itchy skin. So I'll do a workup around diagnosing whether or not that's the case. I've also had patients with zinc and vitamin A deficiency that present with pigmentation, and when we improve their zinc vitamin A status, the pigmentation starts to reduce.
Dr. Heather, we have run out of time. I'm sorry we didn't get to all the messages that have come in. As always, it's great to have your advice and your voice on the show. All of Dr. Heather's details are up on the website, dubaii1038.com/dubaitoday. Connected to the social media as well. She works at Intelligent Health on the Beach Road. So if you want to connect with her directly, you can do so. Until the next time, Dr. Heather, thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne. It's been a real pleasure.